Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. And if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Goodbye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it. He has won his fourth Indianapolis 500.
Beyond the Bricks with jQuery and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store. On 93.5 and 107.5, The Fan.
Inside the Bet365 Command Center, jQuery along with Mike Thompson, Landon Kunz, the man that puts it all together for us here. It is another installment of Beyond the Bricks. And what does that mean? It means it is a race week at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Good evening to you. It is our pleasure once again to join you to talk about the storylines, the personalities, the teams, the drivers, and all of the events that have taken place historically at the world's most famous racetrack at 16th and Georgetown, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And Mike Thompson is, for those of you who are new to the program, a historian from an audio standpoint, from a variety of standpoints, but certainly in terms of the history of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway as told through an audio variation. Mike has a library that is like, as a matter of fact, he lives in the state of Ohio, and for years when you see those videos or pictures on Facebook of LeBron James' old house outside of Cleveland that he's trying to sell that's like 130,000 square feet, that actually is Mike's audio library, is what that is. And Mike, it is always fun once again to resume and talk about a place that is so special to both of us.
Man, my house gets bigger every time we do this show. They're not paying me that much, buddy. But it's always fun to do it. And I really appreciate the opportunity. And we get so many people who come up to us and say so many nice things. And people came up in May. And I actually had a couple people. It was kind of strange because a couple people at the memorabilia show in May were like, I want to get a picture with you because you're on Beyond the Bricks. And that was the first time that's ever happened. And it was just kind of fun, you know. So I don't think of myself in any kind of celebrity status from doing the show, but it's just fun that people love the show so much. And I know you have people call in and talk to you about doing the show and how much, you know, they enjoy listening to you, Jake. So it's a lot of fun for us.
And a lot of those folks, I realize, are listening not in our original airing on 107.5 The Fan in Indianapolis or 93 WIBC, depending on what the schedule lays out, but oftentimes in podcast form after the fact or throughout the course of the year. So if you are one of those, it is appreciated as well. Mike, let's begin by talking about the last time that we were together and doing a show. Of course, this is the week that the NASCAR series comes to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. There is a history there. We'll cross into some of that over the course of the week, but also the Indianapolis 500 taking place in May. I thought personally, and you look back, and it's funny because it was just 2 months ago, but in some aspects it feels like a long time ago because there have been so many races and things that have happened since then that we'll get into. But when you look back at the 2025 Indianapolis 500-mile race, it is one of those to me that I think years from now, and I remember saying after the fact, this is one of those races where years from now, and I was saying this right, you know, after the race ended, we will remember perhaps Scott McLaughlin spinning before the race began and knocking himself out of the race. And we will remember a rain delay to start the race and Alex Palou winning the race. And there was not a lot memorable that took place in the in-between. And that's not a knock on the race or the drivers or the speedway, but there are certain years where it just comes down to it, where the race just feels like there wasn't a whole lot of happening within it. That's not to say there wasn't. But I really thought, Mike, and I've said this before, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway is a very weather-dependent facility. And for those that have never been there, what I mean by that is, I've always said, when it's a clear day or a sunny day, there's no more glorious place on earth to be. And when it's a rainy day and a waited out day, there is no more frustrating, depressing place on earth to be, because you want so badly to see your memories and have everything be perfect the way it's been in the past. This year's race had kind of a little bit of both, but the fact that they had to basically go through all of the pre-race, then not a pour down rain, but enough just drizzle. I call it frust raining. There was just enough to interrupt things, and you kind of had to hurry up and wait. And I just thought, Mike, it kind of set a tone for the day.
Oh, I agree. I mean, it's so frustrating to be at the Speedway when it's raining, or just like you said, enough rain to cause a delay or difficulties. It's just such a frustrating. There's so many days I've been out there where it's just like almost like a mist, and it's just enough to lose the track enough to cause problems. And it did. It was a kind of a disjointed. The whole month of May was disjointed for me in general, and it just felt a little bit disjointed. And I look back at one thing that I don't think got enough discussion in May, which was you have to feel for Ryan Hunter-Reay and those guys, because I think Ryan Hunter-Reay had that race won. If he doesn't run out of fuel, I just have this gut feeling that Ryan Hunter-Reay wins that race. And it's just one of those things that got away for that Dreyer and Reinbold team. And that would have, what a story that would have been for Hunter-Reay to win his second race, and for Dreyer and Reinbold, a little team that could have, you know, knocked off the big teams. And I think they have to be really lamenting the fact that they kind of let one get away, in my opinion.
And the same thing that happened to Ryan Hunter-Reay happened to Joseph Newgarden. And by that, I mean, and I don't know, I'm not an engineer, Mike, but it's my understanding. In Hunter-Reay's case, for example, when he ran out of fuel, he ran low. They had enough fuel to get him back into pit road. But once the fuel gets to a certain point of being low, then it's a problem of getting it to go into the fuel line. And that's what happened to Hunter-Reay. I think the same thing happened to Joseph Newgarden in terms of that fuel line went bad. I agree with you that Hunter-Reay, and credit to Dreyer and Reinbold, they did a fabulous job with Hunter-Reay and Jack Harvey both of taking advantage of, you know, caution flags that came out to go off sequence and then put themselves, in Hunter-Reay's case, back into the lead sequence to the point where he was not necessarily off sequence. He put himself in position where he was running up front and was in position, to your point. And I agree that I thought it looked like it was going to go his way. Newgarden as well, considering he had to start shotgun on the field, he absolutely worked his way through the field where he was then there within, at one point, the top five, certainly in the top 10, when his day came to an end. And I really felt like he's another one that things were going his way and starting to set up nicely for him. None of this is to take anything away from Alex Palou, who ended up obviously winning the race and has been historically on a run here to start the 2025 NTT IndyCar season. But the one thing to me that I look at with Palou, and I give him credit for this, Mike, but did not make for great racing for the fans. But Palou was savvy enough to figure out and to know and understand, and I think Marcus Ericsson knew this as well. Once Palou got in front of Ericsson, he then realized that when he had in front of him the tandem of Louis Foster and Devlin DeFrancesco, it was in Palou's best interest to just tuck behind them, because of the weight of the cars with the hybrid now makes it where if you are three or four in line, it's very difficult to step out and make a pass because of the air and the way it works. So Palou knew for that last dozen laps or so, hey, I'll just tuck in behind these two and let them tow me around, and Ericsson's not going to be able to make a move on me. It was a very smart racing strategy from Alex Palou. It did not make for end-of-race drama for the fans.
Oh, I agree, but I think that it does illustrate your point. Alex Palou, I don't think, gets enough credit for how savvy he is. He's a really savvy guy, and we've talked, I think, a little bit on this show about how the guy never gets rattled by anything. I mean, anything happens to him. He had the problem in Mid-Ohio that was, his own doing a couple weeks ago, and that was so uncharacteristic. but just nothing seems to ever rattle the guy. And so I think one of those things that I think we're going to remember down the road about Alex Palou is his racecraft and his savvy. Like you said, when he came up behind Devlin and Louis Foster, there's no reason to pass those guys. If nobody can behind you can pass you, there's no reason to get up there and mix it up with those guys and potentially cause a problem or have an opportunity for you know, Marcus. And it actually worked out, I think, better in the end that Marcus didn't have a chance to pass him, because if Marcus wins and then gets disqualified, that's a disaster. You know, I think even worse than it was finishing second and then getting, you know, disqualified. So it ended up working out pretty well, I think.
And the guy that, and this is what I've always said, Mike, about the Indianapolis 500 and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. There are, And I realize that people can sit here and, you know, you can debate until the cows come home about examples thereof of what I'm about to say. But as a general rule, there are not fluke winners there. When you look at the list of winners at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, by and large, it represents those that were the best drivers of their era or of that year or whatever it may be. And Alex Palou absolutely fits into that category.
Oh, absolutely. And what's also interesting is, have you noticed recently, though, the trend, other than I think the anomaly is the year that Simon Pagenaud dominated, you know, he led over 100 laps. But if you noticed recently, the people who win aren't leading the most laps or dominating the race. I mean, Palou only led, he led the last 14 laps. That's the only time he led in the race. So, you know, the winner is winning, you know, and he's leading only 15, 14, 12 laps. We're not seeing that, other than that one anomaly again, where Pagenaud led like 112 laps or whatever it was that year he had that great duel with Rossi. You know, the winner isn't winning with a huge lap total. You know, Takuma Sato actually led the most laps, and I think Hunter Ray was second. And those two combined led almost 100 laps. And then I think Palou only led like 14 laps.
You know, it was the 2025 Indy 500 won by Alex Palou. It was a year that, unfortunately, Mike, it was the last 500 for some folks that were dear to us personally and dear to the Speedway and their contribution thereof as well. And that is one of the things about the Indy 500 is those people that you work alongside or you cheer alongside, and that's what makes that facility so special. They become family. And since the running of the Indy 500 to today, unfortunately, we have lost some members of family.
That's right. I'm going to say, honestly, this is not going to be my favorite May of all time. I had a really tough May. You know that I got a concussion in May on Mother's Day, of all things. And it kept me from really having much of a conversation that day with my mom, because I ended up in the hospital on Mother's Day. And then sadly, my mom got really sick over the race weekend. And I got a call while I was at the memorabilia show from my sister. And she said, hey, your mom's in the hospital, which wasn't that unusual because my mom had some health problems. So she would go in the hospital one or two times a year. And I honestly was thinking, okay, she'll be in the hospital a day or two like usual, and she'll go to the rehab facility and she'll be fine. And I wasn't thinking anything dire would happen. And then she was getting a little bit worse during the weekend. And then I didn't hear from her on the day of the race. And I thought, okay, this is a little strange that she didn't call me or I didn't get a chance to talk to her. And I got a call with 50 laps to go. I'll never forget this. There were 50 laps to go in the 500. And I got a call from my sister, and I couldn't understand my sister. I finally said to her, you know, you have to, like, I couldn't understand what she was trying to say because she was crying so hard. And she said, they're going to put mom in hospice tomorrow. She's not going to make it. And I was shocked because I wasn't expecting that result. And so we immediately went to Toledo and I was able to see my mom on Memorial Day and communicate with her. And she was able, she had a 2-hour window where she was able to communicate basically a little bit and talk. And I was able to talk to her. And then while I was communicating with her, I had actually left the room for about a 5-minute period and you called me. And I'll never forget this because I was sitting in the hospice and I was just, I had my head in my hands and, you know, crying and had my head in my hands, just kind of thinking, you know, what's coming next year. And they told me 5 minutes before you called me, the hospice lady told me, your mom's going to pass away and it's going to be in the next day or two, things like that. And phone rings. And first the phone rang and it was Donald. And Donald and I had a wonderful conversation. And then I literally hung up the phone and it was you. And you were just calling just to talk about, hey, somebody called and said they love Beyond the Bricks, and you didn't even know what was going on. And I just wanted to thank you because you and Donald both gave me about a 5 minute period where life was normal. And that's really, in that kind of situation, it's really helpful to have a 5 minute period of normalcy. And then, my mom passed away later on that night. It's tough to go through that, and you think you're prepared for something like that, and then it happens. And then, like, I talk to my mom every Sunday, and so a lot of times I would call her before the IndyCar race because, you know, I want to talk to her before the race. And it's sad to say, but you don't want to, you know, if you're concentrating on the race, you want to have had that conversation and not have the phone ring during the race. And now you can't pick up the phone and call her anymore. And so it's a little harder than I expected it would be to not be able to talk to her. But I do want to thank you and the other folks who know about what happened, who've contacted me and have been so kind about it.
Well, Mike, I'll tell you the one thing where I feel really bad, and I say this only because, I think it's something that hopefully most people are of the same mindset, but I have always been under the belief that when someone you know has lost a loved one, even if it's a loved one that you didn't know personally, that it is your duty in friendship to always make an appearance and show support at the calling. Maybe not the funeral itself. I've always, that's maybe for more people that knew the person that passed, but that it's very important to show support at the calling. And unfortunately, because, for those that listen to the program probably know, you live about, or your mother's calling was about 2.5-3 hours from Indianapolis. And the scheduling was such with, and I can't remember if it was a weekday or if it was leading into a race itself, but I remember looking at the note of it and realizing that I would not be able to make it there and back under work circumstances. And I do apologize for that because I think it's very important to be at those things. So, if there was some offer of or display from my behalf of something that helped you through that, I'm glad of that because I felt really, really bad that I was not able to make it to the calling. But certainly, condolences to you, I know, from everybody. And that will continue to be the case, for as long as we're around, right? And the fact that when your mother or your father passes, that's something that will stick with people, obviously, and carry on with them for as long as they are around. So my condolences to you on that. We also know that in the last week, the news came out and somebody who had suffered an illness earlier and then passed away recently. Ron McQueeney was a chief photographer at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and he had been in that position for a number of years. The key thing that people, I guess the best way to say it for those that were not familiar with Ron's work at the Speedway, each and every one of those for years, photographs that you see of the driver after they qualify, where they're standing in their car with the team around, Ron McQueeney was essentially the photographer that would coordinate those pictures. And usually it was out of his camera, those photos that you saw. But Mike, I know that Ron was somebody that you worked with closely in your time at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Yeah, when it's tough to talk about the fact that Ron's gone because he was just such a great guy. He was really, really special. I didn't know him at all, really, until I moved to Indianapolis and then I met him. We kind of hit it off because, he was interested in the history of the Speedway and we would have really fun chats about things like that. And I got to know him when I worked over there he just was just a great guy. And he, when he left, I was really kind of sad when he left because I was thinking, I kind of wanted him to be in that role longer so I could, visit with him longer. But then he went into being the president of the Old Timers Society. And he actually sponsored my, bid to get into the Old Timers Society. And unfortunately, it didn't, it didn't work out that I got to be in the society at that point. I forget what happened, but he sponsored me, and I thought that was going to end up happening, and it didn't end up happening. But I was just honored the fact that he said, hey, I'm going to be your, because you have to have somebody who's in the club basically say, yeah, they're worthy of being in it. And for Ron to say that about me, I was like, that was just a huge honor to me, you know? So he was just a great guy. Like you said, he took so many iconic photographs. Just a great guy. And we've got a really special soundbite that about Ron talking about how he got the job. And then we'll talk a real bit quick on the way back out of it where we got that soundbite.
Here is Ron McQueenie on becoming the chief photographer of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
My boss, Charlene Ellis, decided she wanted to go to a better paying job, and she had a job lined up in Phoenix. And I got wind of it, and I talked to her. I said, do you mind if I try out for the job? She says, no, that doesn't bother me. So I went and talked to the boss, which at the time was Al Blemker, the head of PR, and the photo department was underneath PR. Mm-hmm. There were 8 people that tried for the job, and I was the one that was chosen out of the 8 photographers that wanted that job, and it was like a dream come true. I had no idea that I'd ever get that job. And when I did, it was just the most fascinating thing I'd ever been into. A lot of people would ask me, what do you do the rest of the year? Well, we ship photos around the world to people doing magazines, newspaper articles, TV articles, books, almost anything where a photograph is used, we ship pictures on a daily basis. And I worked the dark room. I had an assistant with me to do darkroom work for a while.
Ron McQueenie had began his work at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in the early 70s. He became the chief photographer in 1977, passed away, Mike, on July the 15th.
Yeah, and we got that soundbite from Sean, and I want to give Sean a shout out. Sean and his website, Voices of Racing. So if you go to voicesofracing.com, I actually just called him up kind of out of the blue because I knew he had interviewed Ron, and I said, hey, you know, we do Beyond the Bricks. I'd love to use your soundbite, and you know, I'm not going to just steal your stuff. I'd love to have your a soundbite with Ron for the show. Is it okay if we use it? And so he was very gracious to let us use it, and he's got 4-part series with Ron talking about not only his career but some of his memorabilia and things like that. So make sure you go to voicesofracing.com and check out his interviews with Ron and other folks from the racing world. So I think you'll really enjoy it.
It's not often during the racing season, and Ron McQueenie, by the way, and as should be the goal for all of us, his certainly the footprint, the fingerprints, the ways that he touched the Indianapolis Motor Speedway will be, his legacy will be, the work that he did will have an impact on the Speedway for many, many years to come. So Godspeed certainly to Ron McQueenie and condolences to his friends and family. It's not often during the racing season that we can sneak in a little vacation time, but I did exactly that. And Mike, if you don't mind me saying so, it seemed as though, and I appreciate this, you actually took some interest in the trip that I took.
Very much so. I wanted to hear a little bit about this trip. And so I built the rest of the show around your trip. And so I'm excited to hear about this.
All right. And that is, I went over across the pond and I did so to see a band, and a band that is very, very, very beloved in the country of England. It's not Mike's favorite band, but they're close to him, although that's a subject of debate in the United Kingdom. We'll talk about going over to see Oasis and how that plays into the history of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We'll talk about all of that when we return to Beyond the Bricks.
Every builder gets weighed down by clutter, chaos, and complications. But with BuilderTrend, you can rise above it. No more juggling multiple tools, just one platform with infinite possibilities. Streamline products, align your team, and keep operations, financials, and materials in check. It's a night and day difference. Where chaos ends, confidence begins. Learn more and get started today at buildertrend.com/no more chaos.
This is the Bet365 Command Center. Get your race updates here all month long and make sure to enter for your chance to win $500 by predicting the winner of this year's race on July 27th. Go to 1075thefan.com to enter. Now, here's your 2025 race update brought to you by Bet365.
And the race update update. We will simply give you the schedule of things that are going to be taking place coming up this weekend at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We'll begin by talking about what's going to take place on Saturday. 11 o'clock in the morning, the gates will open. And then at 1 p.m., it is qualifying for the Xfinity cars at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. At 2:35, it is qualifying for the Cup cars. That will take place until 3:30. And then at 4:30, it is the Pennzoil 250 taking place, followed by Sunday at 2 o'clock. It will be the running of the Brickyard 400 at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
This is what it sounded like seeing Oasis live at Heaton Park in Manchester, England, which I had the pleasure of doing. You got to turn that up a little bit here, Lane. You don't look back in anger about anything, really. There's nothing to be gained by that. Let me tell you, Mike, how it came to be that I went to go see Oasis. And for those that are unfamiliar, Oasis is a British band that had their peak, certainly, and their breakthrough in the early to mid-90s. And at the time that they came about, they were very controversial because they had famously or infamously in England said that they would be bigger than the Beatles. And Liam and Noel Gallagher, two brothers that have a volatile relationship. And shortly, basically, once they hit their zenith in popularity, probably from 95 to 2000, I'll say it in there, their relationship was on again, off again, and it was always, you know, inconsistent. And ultimately, 16 years ago, they broke up and said, that's it, we're not performing together anymore. For me personally, I did what I call a deep dive on the band after that fact. So when I really started listening to Oasis a lot and learning about them, and I mean, I obviously knew of them in their peak popularity, but I started listening to them more and listening to the words, and it started just becoming a reflective thing to me on the time period in which they were so big, which was a great period of my life because the mid-20s are fun for anybody, really. And then I realized, gosh, what a shame, because I really, really like this band now, and but they no longer are playing together. The same can be said of another British band that I really like called The Verve, whose lead singer is a guy by the name of Richard Ashcroft. Oasis announced about a year ago that they would be, in fact, reuniting and that they would be playing 14 shows in the United Kingdom before coming over to the United States. The third and fourth of those shows took place recently in Manchester, and my cousin and I went over to go see them. I saw them on back-to-back nights on a Friday and Saturday at Heaton Park, which is essentially the central park of Manchester, England, Manchester being their hometown. Mike, I will simply say this. Sports, I think, in the Indianapolis 500 and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, the reason that we go back to it every year, the reason we talk about it, the reason we listen to audio of old races and clips is because sports allows us to have a spontaneous bliss amongst the masses and amongst strangers. It bonds people together. Even if you are from totally different backgrounds or totally different neighborhoods or places of employment, if you root for the same team as the guy or gal next to you and a big shot is made, then you have a connection with that person and with other fellow humans. Music does the same thing. And those two concerts, to be there with, they said 80,000, I would say it was probably closer to 100,000 on each night, and have people from all areas of the globe there to see this band and enjoying the same spontaneous bliss. And before you know it, you are singing along with people you've never met before. You're high-fiving guys you've never seen before. You are arm-in-arm with people swaying back and forth. It truly was a magical weekend, and it was an awesome event, and it's the kind of thing that I hope that everybody can find the same kind of spontaneous joy in whatever leisure it is that they find within their hobbies and their habits.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I think that's right, and I think what you undersold a little bit, though, is the fact of how much venom there was between the Gallagher brothers. I mean, these guys couldn't stand each other for over a decade, and the fact that they got back together to do a concert. I mean, that the only thing that would be bigger news is if I walked back into the, you know, facility in the infield. I mean, that's how much contempt there was there. So, I mean, this was amazing, the fact that the Gallagher brothers got back together. And you're right, to have these kind of communal activities and I can't imagine how cool it would have been to be there with all those folks, especially in their hometown. I mean, that has had to have been absolutely amazing, because they're one of those bands that, you know, again, Don't Look Back in Anger is one of my 10 favorite songs of all time. And I can't imagine what that would have been like to hear that song.
You know, and for that matter, Richard Ashcroft was the opening act, and he did Bittersweet Symphony, which is the Verve's biggest hit, Lucky Man and Sonnet. So it was a special evening for certain. One of the things that hit me in being there, even though there were people from all over the world, a lot of the people that I talked to and enjoyed the show with were from Manchester. And I think they were very proud and hospitable about having people coming from so far away to enjoy one of their native products and enjoy it in their city. That's what allowed me, Mike, to really grasp what it's like for people that come to Indianapolis to go to the Indianapolis 500 and have an appreciation for something that, say, you and I just consider our backyard. And yet people from all over the world come to enjoy it. And that connection, I could relate to it. I could relate to how those people felt and what it meant.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things that I think music touches people in such an interesting way. And the Speedway, you're right. I think that's the same thing. The Speedway touches people in a way. And it's one of those things that's it's almost impossible to describe, right? It's hard to explain that to somebody who hasn't been to the Speedway. And then also, you know, it's hard for me to relate at times to people who don't, when music doesn't touch them, just because, you know, I mean, music can overwhelm me at times. And I, the same thing with when the cars come down for the start of the 500, if that doesn't get you going, I don't know. I don't know what that says about people who it doesn't do something for them, but I think you're 100% right. I mean, there's definitely a similarity there.
Now, similarities, as I've mentioned, between and that weekend, by the way, that I was there was during the two-step Iowa race for the IndyCar series. When the schedule came out that IndyCar was going to be when Oasis was, I simply, you know, said, hey, I'm going to essentially take a vacation, a couple days vacation. And Chris Pollack, the general manager of the radio network, said, totally understand. And so that's how that came to be, that I was not there for the Iowa race. But it was interesting coming back from the concert on Friday and watching the Iowa race for IndyCar on Sky Network, which was airing it in Great Britain. And then on Saturday, the Saturday night race, I did that. And then on Sunday, when IndyCar was racing at Iowa, I was actually on the flight back home and was able via Wi-Fi to listen to Mark Janes, Michael Young, and the rest of the group calling the race on the IndyCar radio network, which was very cool. So,
my question is this: I mean, you have a pretty good boss there with Chris Pollack, who I also know, and I like Chris a lot. The fact that you and Nick Yeoman were off on the same weekend and not there in Iowa, I mean, I was like, that was pretty surprising to me, because I mean, you guys are two of the most important people on the network, and to have both you and Nick not there, I was a little surprised that you guys both be off. I mean, it's one thing to have one of your key guys off, but to have both of your key guys, two of your key guys off, I was a little surprised that you were both not there that weekend.
I think it shows the depth of the guys that we, you know, that we all work with, and the people with it, men and women that work at the radio network, and also the understanding. Nick had an opportunity to call a race in Sonoma for PRN, which works with the IndyCar network for the Brickyard coming up. So the marriage and the confluence of those two particular groups, the reason why Nick was not there and I was not there. And so then, you know, Alex Wolf comes over, and, you know, there's a number of the Drake York and others that get involved. So
you have a great bench, if you will. I mean, Joel Sebastianelli and all these other folks that you have come in, Alex Wolf, like you said, Ryan Marine. It's a talented group of folks that you guys work with.
It was a great weekend, no question about it. Now, the reason why we brought it up is because we talked about confluence and you know, the similarities of Oasis and the Beatles. The Beatles had a trip to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and we've mentioned it before, but not really done, as I said, a deep dive on it. So guess what? That's exactly what we'll do next when we return to Beyond the Bricks. Beyond the Bricks.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Jake Query, Mike Thompson inside the Bet365 Race Command Center here. Quality Supply and Tool helping bring you Beyond the Bricks. Landon Coons putting it all together for us. Talking about the Beatles and their trip in 1964 to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We've played that up a little bit by telling you about my trip to go see Oasis, but the Beatles came to our fabulous facility back in 1964, and there was not necessarily always the plan that they would stay at 16th and Georgetown, but that's in fact where they would lay their heads while playing at the Indiana Fairgrounds Coliseum. Speedway historian emeritus Donald Davidson on why the Beatles stayed at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Apparently, the groups regularly stayed at the Essex House downtown, and for whatever reason. And in 1964, basically what you had was the big hotels, the big old established hotels downtown, and then the motels on 40, but, you know, there was no 465 yet. I think that was just starting to be built. And so really, there wasn't anywhere else to go except if you went to the downtown area. Well, there was the Holiday Inn, or as I would call it, the Holiday Inn across the street, and then the Speedway Motel had opened in March, or is it approximately Easter of 1963. So that's where they decided that the Beatles could go because the general crowd wouldn't figure it out.
Chuck Gunderson is an author that covers the Beatles, and he also gives his version of the decision to stay at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway for the Fab Four.
Had the Beatles toured in the social media age and the Facebook and Twitter age, I mean, we would know exactly where they were at all times of the day and night. We would have photos of them, everything. And it was thought that they were going to stay at the Essex House, but that wasn't the case. Brian, or really Tour Management, which was General Artists Corporation, who handled the tour. They were a talent agency out of New York City. They actually booked all the hotels and things like that. Well, they booked the Speedway Motel, which, you know, it's great for indie car drivers, but for the Beatles, it wasn't such a great place because of its layout. But the Speedway Motel had open corridors and kind of an open parking lot for fans to really kind of get in there and try to work their way in to get to see the Beatles.
Mike, I like this next clip because this is from a local television station and their coverage, correct, of the Beatles?
That's correct. Wish TV actually did a show called My or Our Fair Beatles, which ran in September of 64, kind of covering the Beatles' whole trip to Indianapolis. It's a really cool show that you can actually find on YouTube.
In the morning, the remarkably well-kept secret began to leak out. People whispered that the Beatles were housed at the Speedway Motel. The screaming, violent crowds of people were still not in evidence. A few faithful fans maintained a vigil outside the police lines in hopes of getting a glimpse of just one Beatle. The policemen, ready for any emergency, waited.
Mike, not unlike when you walk through the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, there's always a buzz, right, about that. So you can only imagine what it was like when the Beatles were there and just some of the protocols, I would imagine, that had to take place, right?
That's right. Donald, I actually talked to him about the different protocols because people were calling the switchboard. They had a switchboard there at the Speedway Motel, and people obviously wanted to talk to any member of the Fab Four they could get a hold of. So Donald talked about how they put some protocols in place to keep that from happening.
They must have had a little bit of an entourage, but they didn't have a bunch of roadies like they do now. And honestly, I don't know what the traveling group consisted of, but they did put out a kind of a red herring that the Essex House was where they would be staying. And whatever extra people that they had, that's where they stayed. And again, they didn't have like 30, 40, 50 people and truckloads of equipment and everything. It was a very simple setup in those days. So they booked the three rooms. And a gentleman I knew very well named David Cassidy happened to be the manager of the motel. And he told me all these stories. And he said that they booked three rooms and Brian Epstein had one. And then the boys, believe it or not, doubled up two by two in the other two rooms. And he said, we knew that we'd probably be getting a lot of phone calls. And so the word was at the switchboard, don't put any calls through unless because you'll have people with all kinds of excuses and everything to try and talk to the Beatles. If they've either figured that they're there or guessed that they're there. And they said that if it is an official call, when it comes in, you will be told Liverpool calling, even if it's from here. Liverpool calling will be the password that's an official call, and put them all through to Brian Epstein. Don't put any to the other two rooms.
Jerry Baker was a longtime voice of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network. Not only that, but he also happened to be the familiar voice that introduced the Beatles to the crowd in Indianapolis.
1 minute, okay? Just one quick second. Thanks a million for being such a great crowd. I didn't come up through the Frank Sinatra age. I think Frank is one of the greatest. I missed the Sinatra era. I was right in the middle of the Elvis Presley era. But I have never in my life seen anything like you-know-who. On behalf of all of the State Fair Board and all the good guys from WIFB, may I present the Beatles!
Ringo Starr was one of them that said, you know what, I'm not just going to be cooped up in the hotel room, Mike. He decided to actually take his own little tour of Indianapolis, correct?
That's right. This story has taken on a bit of a life of its own, as Ringo's told several different versions of this story. But this is one version he told of the story to David Letterman, and when David Letterman had his talk show.
Yeah. You must have been at one of them.
I was in Indianapolis.
Everybody was in Indianapolis.
And there was a story after the shows there, and you probably heard this if in every city you attended. That you stayed up all night and drove around town with a police officer.
Yeah.
Now, was that true, or was that just...
That's one of the true stories.
Yeah. And why Indianapolis? Why a policeman? Why?
It was a friendly policeman who thought, let me drive the police car. And I said, yeah, and we were driving around. The funniest bit that no one else knows is that we were chased by another cop car.
Is that right?
And we had to drive up an alley and turn the lights out and hide. And I'm hiding with this cop in an alley so we didn't get caught.
See, that would have been bad if you'd gotten gunned down in an Indianapolis alley and some kind of police shootout.
You don't think of that.
Or the other thing, you could have made citizens' arrests all night.
I could have arrested the cop who let me drive his car.
Chuck Gunderson with more on Ringo's big night on the town.
The concert had been played, and he just couldn't get to sleep, so he wandered outside the Speedway Motel and talked the troopers into taking him on a tour in their police cruiser and see some of the sights of Indiana. So they dropped by the governor's mansion, and they drove around downtown Indianapolis. And then the trooper had a great idea. He wanted to take Ringo Starr out to his farmhouse outside in the country. And they arrived in the early morning, and his wife was actually getting the horses ready to be shown at the Indiana State Fair that day. And she was just looking at Ringo like, well, who's this guy that you brought home? She could care less. Well, one person really cared, and that was the officer's daughter. She was 11 years old at the time.
The Beatle that was most interested in the tour of the Speedway, because the Beatles did take a tour of the Speedway as well, was George Harrison. Donald Davidson on where George Harrison's interest in racing came from.
Graham Hill, and then later Damon Hill. He was apparently was very fond of. And I've always thought that Damon Hill and George Harrison looked very alike. I mean, I'm not maybe quite to the point of being brothers, but they could almost be related. I mean, I know brothers that look less alike than those two do. But where his interest in motorsports came from, I don't know, except that British people tend to be interested in motor racing, except that he's the only one of the four that I know had an interest, but it was quite extensive, and he would go to the British Grand Prix. He never came to the Indianapolis 500 as far as I know, but he did go to Long Beach. Anyway, to my knowledge, he never came to a 500 here.
Mike, I know how much you love the Beatles. I know how much you love the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. I feel like we could do an entire 2 hours on nothing but Beatles and IMS.
There's no question about that. We could easily do 2 to 4 hours hours on both of those things.
I will tell you that during my trip, I also went to the Cavern Club in Liverpool, where the Beatles played 292 times, and it was very, very cool. But not as cool as the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. But what is? That's why we talk about it each and every night, anytime that there's a race taking place at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway on this program that we call Beyond the Bricks. We thank you for listening to it tonight. So much fun. We'll do it again tomorrow. For Landon Coons and Mike Thompson, I'm Jake Query. We will talk to you tomorrow.